Hello, everybody, and welcome to the On the Farm Pitcherless podcast about all things prospect, dynasty, and minor league related. Everybody, of course, you got to make sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless Podcast Network. Leave us a rating and review if you do so choose. You could follow the On the Farm podcast at PL On the Farm on Twitter, as well as Rick at Must Be the Hawk and myself at Jake Mache. Send us any questions that you would like to go over in the future episodes. But for now, for this episode, we are back from a little break. Life is a little hectic, and I am moving yet again as an update to everybody. I am going, so last year, as if anyone remembers, I was in Cincinnati, moved to Rhode Island, cross country, and then now I'm redefining what cross country means to myself and going to Los Angeles. Because I fell in love with somebody who is just too darn smart, and my fiance is doing a PhD program at USC, and so we're going out there for the fall, but that means that there's a lot of logistics that have to happen. Oh, and she's my fiance, so we are planning a wedding. But, you know, life happens, it gets busy, and we are here ready to talk baseball. I am joined, of course, by my intrepid co-host, as the one, the only Lamar Gibson would say, Rick. The Hawk, Hake, how's it going, man?
Oh, man, it's going pretty well. That's a fantastic intro, by the way. And you have the trifecta going on, man. You got everything going on, really. So,
it for better or worse, Rick. For better or worse, yes.
There you go.
Yes. No, it's, you know, it's, we all keep on chugging on, and it's wonderful. You know, the weather's starting to get nicer. Got my windows open. So sorry if y'all hear any wild things happening out in the neighborhood, but you know, it's a good time of year. The college baseball season is advancing, and we're getting some tournament play. We'll talk about that a little bit. Rick, of course, is always on the road for one reason or another, and he's checking out all these games, getting some live looks for us. We're going to talk about the things that he has seen recently at the games that he has watched, and you know, just kind of talk about some guys who debuted recently, a little bit of everything, getting back into the swing of things here. And then before you know it, we're going to be starting draft coverage. The draft is coming up. The All-Star Weekend is coming up. Festivities, all the good stuff, all the sleepers, all the teams that will make horrible decisions. White Sox. And we'll see how it goes. You know, it's a good, great time. Everyone has their fantasy teams also doing really well. Rick, how are your fantasy teams doing? Really, really curious here. What's the lowdown?
Yeah, so... Yeah, so this time of the year coming up is like the most wonderful time of the year for dynasty managers left and right and us prospect aficionados all around. As for my teams this year, my 10-team league, absolutely dominating. Honestly, making them probably cry, I would say. I am currently second in two of my 30-team dynasty leagues, so I'm doing very well there. Currently fifth in another. One of them, I am, I believe, 15th. So I'm about middle of the pack. Kind of confused on what I'm going to do with that going forward. And one of which, just like the one league, actually, you might actually remember this, the league that I ended up doing the startup draft in.
Yes.
Yeah, it's my Cardinals league. And I ended up having the misfortunes of taking Matt McClain in the first overall.
Oof.
My first round, not overall, but my first round pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was near the back end of the first round. And yeah, so that hurt. And then my second round draft pick was Josh Jung.
Ah, brutal.
Yeah. So
that's
the
not
two
your
of them,
year.
No. So I went batter heavy in that league. So the pitching has just been absolutely atrocious. And the Hurst and Waltrip pick that I took first prospect overall, it did not work because, that's, you know, tough. They brought in Sale.
Yeah, Sale really clogged it up. Yep.
Yeah. No. So that's
and he's staying healthy, which is a real pain. What a jerk.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. And now Waltrip's, you know, doing it, but is he going to play?
Exactly.
Where's he going to pitch? So that one's a little rough. Besides that, I mean, been pretty pretty solid for the most part between those two leagues, my Guardians League and my my Cardinals League. But what are you going to do? You can't win them all.
Jay. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I've been doing all right. So Dynasties, top five, in my Dynasties. I have two Dynasties right now. I had three. So I'll focus on the two that are currently happening first. The one Rotisserie League, 12 team. I am in fourth. Been bouncing back and forth between like fourth and seventh because we're all in a bunch of like 3 points separating us, and then the top three teams are like 10 points ahead of the pack. And so I've been falling for like 3 weeks now, and try because I got like Trout got injured, Jung-Hoo Lee got injured, who else? I have Matt McClain on that team, Tristan Casas. I mean, like the whole list, you know. So that's, I've been trying to play the wire a little bit. And then what's my other one is the Pitcher List Dynasty League, 14 teams. That one's head-to-head categories. And it started out strong, and then I've been kind of playing the middle. So now I'm in fourth there. And the third was a fascinating situation, Rick. I actually haven't told you about this yet. But I did a startup, not a startup. I orphaned a team in the offseason. And everything was going great. And I like made a couple trades. I made a trade with somebody, and I was like, that wasn't a fun process, but whatever, disregarded it. Then later on, a trade went through, and it was deemed to be incredibly lopsided by the league. I can't even go back and look at it now because the league has since been nuked. But this trade went through, and everyone was immediately like, that's insane. And it was ran by the commissioner, like a commissioner that commissions a bunch of leagues, and everyone was trying to get the rationale for the league, and the people involved weren't willing to say anything, and everyone was just like losing it in the chat. And I had just joined like a month earlier, and so I'm kind of sitting off to the side like, gulp, what's happening?
Oh,
and I mean, like, people are, it's getting intense. And then the guys eventually came in, offered a little bit, but like it kind of was a thing where one manager was a problem and was like really essentially bullying people in trade negotiations, and it was like a whole thing. And the league ended up folding. Like the commissioner came in and was like, I'm literally ending this. He sent a message and then just shut down the league like 5 minutes later.
Wow.
Yeah. So then we're all in the Twitter chat. This is in week two, Rick. This was week two of the season.
Wow. I don't know if I've ever seen that.
Right. Like I was so shocked. I was okay, that's TMI. Never mind. I was gonna tell you where I was when I was doing it. I was at work and taking a break, if you will. And I was so shocked. Oh my God. Because like I had never like, people are always jerks, right? Like you do enough dynasty leagues, people get upset, you know, whatever. And like, it's part of it. It is what it is. But I have never, like, that quick and swift of a, you know what, I'm done with this. I don't like, this isn't worth it. Bye. Like, everyone, bye. So that was wild. And
wow.
I can't believe this hasn't come up. I totally forgot about it. I think I just got so mad and like so just like frazzled by it. I just couldn't. It took a minute for me to like get over it. But yeah, so that was fun. So now I only have two. I had four last year, and I was like, that was too much with the other leagues that I did. So I went down to three, and I was comfortable with the three, and then that one. And so I was like, now I feel like I don't have enough. And
so see, now I'm petitioning for Jake to be able to get into a 30-man league now. I feel like it's right. When a spot comes available, this is an orphan team that will not blow up. I promise.
Yeah.
There's too much at stake. Yeah. I can't believe that, man. I don't know if I've ever been in a situation in which that a league folds not in the off season.
Right.
Because I've done
week
that
two, in the season. Yeah.
Yeah, but in season week two, like. Wow.
Yeah.
And
no, that was illegal.
Nobody would come forward. Yeah, that should be illegal.
Yeah.
That should be illegal. You should be put in fantasy jail, dynasty jail, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, at least I got refunded, but no, and I was super mad because that was a league I talked about on this podcast where I had inherited, the Yankees pitching prospect that like kind of popped up this offseason.
Was it with Hampson?
No, see, now I don't remember him because he's not on my teams anymore.
There you go.
Dang, but you know, it was, I was excited for the team, you know, it was a good team. Anyway, yeah, jeez. So... just always, I guess, I you can't even, I don't even know what you do to avoid that situation, because like you really, you go into league and you're like, well, we'll see how this goes. But all right, so those are the dynasty leagues. Those are how those are going. Redraft is going all right. I think I have like 8 teams in redraft, and I'm in first in 2 of them, and then top 6 in 5 of them, and then one of them's in dead last. And that one was in a salary cap draft that I did, and I had my first pick was Strider, or my highest. I think I spent like $50 on him. Yeah. And then McLean was also up there, and it was just like when you start with like $60 less than everybody else, it's like not gonna happen. So hanging in there, that's my goal for the first like 2 months, like really through Memorial Day weekend, is just hang in there. And then try to do something in the middle months and then hang on at the end. And, you know, but I'm glad that there's only one team that is truly skunked as of right now. But you never know. It's a long season.
Yeah.
So beyond the updates and everything else, let's talk about some debuts that have happened recently. So since we've last put out an episode, there's been a ton of great debuts. I mean, most notable, of course, is Paul Skeens, who was called up, has since made 3 starts, including a 6-inning gem against the Cubs at Wrigley Field, where he struck out 11, didn't allow a hit or run, of course, and had 1 walk. And as a fun fact here, he was the first Pirates pitcher to strike out 11 in Wrigley Field. So, I mean, he's just been really, really good. Just
isn't
goes to show that
crazy.
Yeah.
Of the long storied history that Pittsburgh has, he is the first one to do it at Wrigley Field.
Yes.
That's so nuts.
Considering both Wrigley Field and the Pirates have been around since like the early 1900s, you know?
Yeah.
It's wild. And here comes Paul Skeens, who, you know, was the biggest prospect since Strasburg, but still not guaranteed to be good. And then, you know, sometimes good guys are just good throughout, you know? But it is what it is. I actually don't have Skeens on any of my teams.
Me neither.
Redraft, nothing. It's sad. It's really fun to watch, but it'd be just a little bit more fun if it benefited me, unfortunately.
Something about taking Waltrip.
Yeah. Was Skeens available when you did that? Not to rub salt in the wound. He was.
Yes.
Right.
I needed pitching now. And Waltrip was like super, like he had the inside track.
He was
literally.
I could see that. Yeah.
No.
Well. Yeah.
Such is life.
Brutal. Exactly. Another debut. Brian Ramos, third baseman for the White Sox, called up. Has played well in his 10 games. He slashed .281, .294, .344, with 2 ribbies. Had a IL stint in the middle there. He's given something for the White Sox, some sort of hope, from a young guy, and we'll see what they can bring in at the deadline when they sell off the guys like Pham and, Kopech and whatnot. But, you know, he's offering something. He's hitting the ball pretty well. Just like what Rick, you mentioned before the show, his OBP has been pretty bad. But it wasn't horrible in the minors. So he's been really aggressive at the plate. So we'll see how that pans out. AJ Smith Shaver, just made a season debut on Thursday and called up for Atlanta. He went 4.1 innings, 3 hits, 2 walks, 4 strikeouts, no earned runs. He was really struggling at AAA to start the year. But he was the next up, you know, the next man on the list and ahead of Waldrop. So he got the opportunity. And I mean, he's been with the organization longer. I know, Rick, it's again, salt in the wound. But very, very clear hierarchy, it seems like, for the Braves in general, how they operate. One of those organizations that really values, you know, experience in the org, experience at a level, and Here we have Rick's just shaking his head the whole time. So here we have AJ Smith-Shawver, who got up last year and was one of the first to get back and do it this year. And like we said, Chris Sale is just too good. But looking at the, even with Strider out, you know, the Braves look a lot more, have a lot more depth than what I think was originally thought early in the offseason. But Waldrop will absolutely get his chance again. Sale doesn't have a great injury history. Morton is, like 38 and doesn't have a great chance of making it healthy throughout the year, you know. So you never know. We'll get some opportunities as it goes on for Waldrop to come up as well. Then we have Christian Scott, called up from the Mets, has had three starts with 17 strikeouts over 16.2 innings and a 4.32 ERA. Got a ton of hype. I mean, he really was just fantastic in the upper levels in the minors. Really very, very quickly, as pitching prospects tend to do, moved up through the rankings and in industry rankings and general, you know, excitement of the fans, and came up to some huge fanfare, and he's been all right so far. The results have been about average, but he looks really good. His arsenal looks fantastic. And he's just got some, his wipeout breakers and the fastball looks good. And so yeah, he's going to be great. Mason Black, called up for the Giants. He's been called up, I think, two or three different times. Has pitched in four games, three starts with 10 strikeouts over 14.1 innings and an 8.79 ERA. I think he did a little bit better Thursday. He appeared in after an opener that the Giants used in a day game there and did a little bit better, but he hasn't looked good. And I was just looking at his kind of his peripherals, his profile earlier, and it's hard to pick out something that you can hang your hat on with him right now. And at the end of the day, not a huge velocity guy. He's kind of a kitchen sink type of pitcher. He really, I think, relies a lot on his command and the changeup, which, as we know, isn't the formula for like high ceiling success, you know. So he just kind of hopefully gets to a point where maybe he becomes more of an innings eater and can kind of maintain a low 4 ERA for you and maybe do like 8K per 9 and hopefully can settle into that. But right now it's looking tough. And the last guy we'll talk about here, Robert Gasser, lefty for the Brewers, who was called up and has made three starts, striking out six batters over 17 innings with 2.65 ERA. I mean, we knew in the minors that he had developed really great control over the last about two seasons, developed it really well. And he is, again, another guy that has a kitchen sink approach, but he's always gotten really great whiff numbers still in the minor leagues, despite the fact that he has low velocity, that he has just a ton of pitches that he kind of throws at guys and doesn't have the kind of stereotypical strikeout stuff, but he's always still gotten really good strikeout numbers in the minors and the upper levels of the minors. And, well, haven't quite seen that so far in the majors, but he has not allowed runs. So it's kind of which one's going to give out first, because it probably won't continue. I mean, it can. You get guys like Martin Perez had that really great season. You know, Miles Michaelis had a solid season and that kind of, you know, and Merrill Kelly maybe give shrug your shoulders. Yeah, that's what it is. So we'll see. I like Gasser though, because I think from the left-hand side, that velocity plays up just a little bit more. And his pitches, I think, work really well off of each other. So I would take him over Mason Black for sure. Rick, what are your thoughts? Do you have any thoughts? Anything stuck out for you for these guys? I know you're Mets fans. Maybe you've seen Christian Scott pitch a little more than I have. Or any thoughts on Black versus Gasser?
Yeah, so Christian Scott, he primarily, if anything, I'd be buying more into Christian Scott right now. The 4.32 ERA to start with might be a little bit disconcerting for some dynasty managers. But I think that there's better days to come for him. He lives in the zone. He absolutely lives in the zone. And one of the main things in his debut, I believe it was Adam Wainwright that was on the national televised game for that. And he was saying if he's able to expand outside of the zone, he will get more swing and miss at the major league level. You will not be able to continually go inside the zone all the time and get strikeouts and avoid getting hit. Because with a pitcher with higher velocity, as we've seen multiple times, Jake, you will be crushed because they can time up a fastball. That's not a hard thing, but you got to be able to move it outside the zone. I think that he's going to be able to get to that. Now, you know, once again, remember, Christian Scott doesn't have much mileage on his arms. He's a converted reliever from Florida, pushed through the Mets farm system very, very quickly. So they're going to be monitoring his innings pitched, and they're going to be working with him a little bit further. If anything, this is a time to buy, in my opinion. So I'm really in on Christian Scott there. Mason Black, I saw his debut. And man, what a tough luck draw against the Phillies. I know that they wanted to pitch him in his, you know, his favorite team growing up. He's from Lehigh. So, you know, this was a homecoming for him. But man, what a critical lineup that you have to face right out the gates. And they did not hold back on him.
Yeah.
He had a good, like, inning and a half. Where it looked great. Struck out Stott, struck out Harper, looked good, and then it just imploded. And the problem was that they had no bullpen. They used them the day before in a long inning game, so he was just left out there. And one other thing, Jake, before we move on, and I'm not going to rant too long on this, can we please stop bringing up these minor league pitchers to only pitch like two or three innings at a time, you know, and then ramp them up so slowly in the beginning of the year? Because you brought up Mason Black. He never pitched above 60 pitches in a start up to that point in AAA, and you made him go all the way to 95 pitches. If you're trying to take care of the guy, then you don't do that. Why would you do that in the minor leagues to begin with? It makes no sense to me. This is why we have spring training. This is why we build up over the offseason. I get that they want to protect elbows, but Mason Black's not a flamethrower.
Mm-hmm.
He should be the one.
Overcorrection for the protecting of the elbows, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And like, you got pitchers like Carson Palmquist with Colorado, and he's going out there eight innings every time, pretty much right out the gates. Like, can we stop? If it's a high-velocity pitcher like, you know, Noah Schultz or something like that, I get it.
Mm-hmm. But not like what they're doing with Paul Skeens.
Yeah.
Yeah, not Mason Black.
And then you're going to bring him up to eat innings? That makes
no
sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's like the saving bullets argument, but they have to be thrown, you know, like, you just have to throw, you know, to get ready for the season, to get ready to appear in the majors, like... It is what it is. Yeah, like you said, going 60 pitches like for 6 weeks, and then all of a sudden going not only increasing that output by 50%, but doing it against the best hitters in the world.
And it was sad. I mean, it was sad. You saw the velocity dip. You saw the movement go away from his slider, and the changeup just was not, there was nothing.
Yeah.
It was sad.
Yeah, man. Oh, man. Pitching. Ah, man. Yeah. The way the workers are handling pitching is tough. Yeah. And everyone's doing it a bit differently, you know? But yeah, I love what you said about Christian Scott and better days ahead. I mean, just looking at his stats, like you said, he's in the zone a ton. It's a 66% strike rate, which is awesome. And he, like you were saying, like when he does go out of the zone, he gets chases. It's 34% chase rate, which is a couple ticks above league average, and a 14.5% swinging strike rate. So he is doing the best. He's doing the good stuff that you want to see, and he just kind of needs to put it together a little bit. So, you know, love Christian Scott and think that he's going to rebound really nicely. But we're going to go on a break here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about some things that are happening at the college level. And then after that, we're going to talk about Rick's live looks. So stick with us, and we'll be back in a sec. All right, and we are back. And I wanted to go over some fun stuff that's happening right now in the amateur circuit. There are all the conference tournaments in college baseball are happening right now for all the biggest conferences. All of the championship games that determine the automatic bids to the national tournament, those championship games are this Sunday, and then it is Selection Sunday, so we'll see the full field of teams in the national tournament to eventually make it to the College World Series. So I want to give you all a rundown of what's been happening so far, some cool stuff that I've been seeing, and just what you can look forward to if you tune in this weekend to watch some of the things that are happening. Starting with the SEC, which is the undisputed best conference in the country features four seeds. Four of the top five seeds nationally are from the SEC. The conference is extremely deep. They're probably going to get 11 teams in the national tournament. By the projections, the bracketologists, if you will. And what's been crazy about the SEC is that the league is so good that this tournament is always complete chaos. And we saw that in the technically the second round of the tournament. So the seeds 5 through 12, I believe, have a single elimination kind of section of the tournament. And then the winners, the four teams that come out of that, face the top four seeds. And then it becomes a double elimination tournament bracket. And all of the top four seeds, which are four of the top five national seeds, they all lost. And so then it creates two elimination games, each featuring two top five teams. And so what we had was Arkansas and Arkansas, Kentucky, Texas A&M, and Tennessee. Texas A&M lost Tennessee, and then Arkansas lost Kentucky. So Tennessee is ranked number one overall in the nation. Kentucky ranked number two. They got out of it. So then they have to play the losers of the teams that are in the winner's bracket. And so I think it's going to be a really cool situation. It's probably going to be something where you have a, like, quote unquote underdog in the SEC. It's still a very good baseball team. In the championship for the league, then you have probably Tennessee or Kentucky having to win two. And so I think I love those situations when you have the undisputed better team having to win two games and that underdog getting the extra one there. It's such a fun scenario because, you know, usually the better team even has home field advantage, and it's just the intrigue there is great. It's such a unique part of these tournaments, these double elimination tournaments, where eventually you have to win twice if you're coming out of the loser's bracket. So that's something that'll be fun to watch going into this weekend, to see which teams kind of come out of that insane mess, and then how it also impacts bids, you know, for the national tournament. And then we have the ACC is probably the second best conference. It's projected to have the second most teams in the tourney. It's been wide open. We were talking about Wake as the preseason number one team, Wake Forest. Rick, I know you love your Wake Forest there. You kind of try to see them a lot. And they had a so-so season. They ended up, they kind of up and down. They kind of ended the regular season pretty poorly and are the 22nd ranked national team and the 8th seed in the conference tournament. And that's another one that's wide open. And another cool thing about the ACC tournament, specifically in the Pac-12 tournament as well, they do pool play. So they have four groups of three teams, and those three teams play each other, and the best team in each of the four groups move on to the semifinals. And so we've had NC State and Miami already clinch their pools. And Miami was a huge upset. Miami beat Clemson, who is that one team in the top five nationally that is not an SEC team. They're Clemson's number three nationally. Miami just beat them today, knocked them out, and then are moving on to the semis. And then tomorrow, we're going to have UNC versus Wake, who are two ranked teams, and FSU, Florida State versus Virginia, also two nationally ranked teams, each play each other for those spots in the semifinals as well. So that's going to be awesome. And then we're going to have that tournament finish up on Sunday as well. Pac-12 tournament. As we all know, the Pac-12 is no longer going to be a thing. Starting like in a couple months is when the football season starts, and all these teams are going to be redistributed. And I actually don't know what's happening with like the two teams that are left over. I think it's Washington State and Oregon State maybe, but it's a mess. Anyway, this is the final Pac-12 tournament for baseball, as the Pac-12 as we know it. And what was really cool, Stanford has been a powerhouse in college baseball for years, and they stunk it up this year. And they've ended up going on a 10-game losing streak to end the regular season. But somehow won both of their two pool games and are now in the semifinals. And they face Arizona, who is the number one seed in the conference and the number 18 national team, for the shot to go to the conference tournament. So that could be a huge bid-stealing situation, as we see in the seeding for the national tournament. And I think that is a really cool situation to watch. Again, the Pac-12, it's just, we've seen this for the last, you know, few iterations of the different sports having their different tournaments, the kind of the last dance. And this one is just as chaotic as we've seen in others. So obviously pay attention to what's going on there. And then the last of the Power Five conferences that I would like to mention real quick is the Big Ten. Iowa sucks, y'all. And it's been really sad. It's been really sad. Well, Big Ten is not great for baseball. We've known this for a while. They're only going to have like two teams in the national tournament. But Iowa had a shot. You know, they were preseason. They were ranked. I was drinking the Kool-Aid. I was reading the articles. I was going to watch, you know, I was like watching all the games, you know. They dropped out of the rankings the first update and have not even sniffed it since. And they still had a shot in the conference tournament. I was holding out hope that they could still make the national tourney. But they lost both games. So that was over pretty quickly. And it happened, and it's like during the week, of course, like I'm writing emails at work and they're getting shellacked in the background. And then I check my phone a couple hours later and it's like, oh, season's over, darn. So thus is the fandom of college athletics and specifically college baseball, because it's brutal. And so that's what's going on. That's the rundown. So many chaotic things, and baseball tournaments are so much fun. We don't really get it at the major league level. It is all very prepared, you know, like very not strict rules, but like, you know, the teams, it's a 3-game series and you have all the fanfare and the travel and it's all very organized. And in college baseball, it's chaos. It is double elimination. You're playing back-to-back days. You're just running through the gauntlet of the tournaments, and you have to upset the seeds. And it's like just a different animal. And baseball in general, like anyone can beat anyone on any day. You know, even the best teams in the country still lose like 12 games, where in college basketball, they lose like two. And so there's so much that can happen in a single baseball game, even in a double elimination tourney, that's chaotic. So watch it, y'all. Tune in to things that are happening. Saturday games usually don't start until like 1 p.m., 2 p.m. in Major League Baseball anyway. They'll be playing at like 9 a.m. So tune in, check out what's going on, and watch some of the guys that we're going to be seeing in the draft in this upcoming All-Star break. And
hashtag watch it, y'all.
Watch it. Yeah. That's awesome. Because then we can all talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Hashtag watch it, y'all.
Yeah. Absolutely. But Rick, so you've been as well, you know, paying a lot more attention to things that are happening in college ball this year. And want to get your take on kind of what's happening in college. So like beyond obviously the tournaments that are happening right now, that's obviously super fun and important, but we've seen this trend the last couple of years that offense is ruling college baseball. You've seen multiple different players break the BB Core era home run record. You know, it was Ivan Melendez first, and then it was Jack Caglione, and then this year it's Charlie Condon. And the ERAs have just ballooned. And there was a great article that was written by a pitcher list, one of our pitcher list own writers on the Dynasty team today, Trevor Powers. Really awesome writer, has been covering college baseball. He's put out a couple articles about, you know, kind of contextualizing what's happening in college baseball, the statistics, what it means for both dynasty managers, but also just baseball fans. You know, how do you look at what's happening in the college and be able to kind of understand that on what we know, how we contextualize Major League Baseball? Because we see ERAs and we're really, really used to kind of operating on like a 2.25 to like a 4.5 to 5 ERA scale. You know, we know what's good in there, but college is a whole different beast. The NCAA, the earned run average across all the Division I teams this year is 6.14. 6.14. Last year it was 6.04. And way back in 2018, it was all the way down to 4.88. Still higher than the major leagues, of course, but not by that much. And still much easier. Oh, God, that was bad. Much more easily digested and understood. But now we see these guys that are drafted with huge ERA, with huge ERAs, which mean a bit different thing than what we've understood in the past. And it's important to have the context for it. So I'm going to link this article in the show notes. So if you're listening and you're interested to learn more about the contextualization of ERAs and runs and the scoring environment in college baseball this year, absolutely check out this article because there's a lot of great information in it. But essentially, the one of the things I took away from this is that there's a lot of value in looking at college players whose college pitchers specifically, whose stats are a bit worse for the wear, but who's had really good skills to back it up and are still performing better than the average Joe in their context, in their league. But when we're looking at it, doesn't look great. And so he has a list of some guys here that are that have been performing well, you know, based on the expectations of the league and based on like the historical context. He brought up Chase Dollander and Hurston Waldrop last year. Dollander had a 4.75 ERA and Waldrop had a 4.16, but they've both been killer in the professional leagues, in the minor leagues, and produced much, much better than that. So also he has a list here that gives a example, you know, a list of six college pitchers who have a bit high ERAs, but have really good skills to back it up and who can be some values in the draft this year. So if you want to go check out that list, go check it out. And he also gives some great breakdowns of those players. But Rick, wanted to get your take here, see your shift, or see how have you seen the shift from, you know, pitcher to hitter in the college game, the live looks that you've seen at this point, you know, the advantages that you've seen for certain player groups. How have you seen that play out in the games that you've watched in person?
So I completely agree 100% with what Trevor is saying in this article. I think it's an amazing article for you guys to go and read. I think that we are, in addition to what he was saying, I think we're also seeing the after effects of the COVID shortened season or gone season for college.
Yeah.
We've seen an influx of high school talent go into professional ball, bypass college altogether and go to professional ball. And we've seen almost a renaissance of those types of prospects skyrocketing up systems. These are a lot of the prospects that would have gone to college and would be competing at a higher level to this point. The bats are, you know, in some respect outweigh the pitchers, but mainly because the back end rotational pieces in college in general have been really rough. You know, like you said, a 6.14 average ERA right now. We were just talking before the show started, and there's a lot of the pitchers that potentially could go in the first, I'd say probably 2 to 3 rounds, that are going to have sub-3 ERAs in this draft. You know, pitchers like Ben Hess, like Prager for A&M, Johnson for Dallas Baptist University. There's a lot of really talented arms in this draft class, in addition to and excluding Burns and Hagen Smith. Those guys are on a whole nother planet in terms of what they're able to do. And I recall last year with Dollander at Tennessee, you know, and Waldrop down in Florida, you're going against the hardest conference in baseball. And last year, like what he said in the article, we were seeing massive home run totals. And at this point, if they're going to be facing off against rough competition, you know, back end rotational pieces, whatever the case might be, the ERAs are going to continue to go up and the home runs are going to continue to go up. I think at some point we're going to see a little bit more of a normalization of this. I think we're seeing more of a peak. But it's very obvious to see whenever you're watching a pitching prospect in college that isn't as highly regarded. I know with Josh Hartle, we had a lot of conversations earlier on in the season, and this was one of the league's elite strikeout pitchers in 2023. And this year, I mean, he was taken out of, you know, the Friday night starter, you know, and pushed back into the rotation. So, you know, I think it's very interesting to be able to look at this, and especially with draft season coming up. Jake, you and I are going to be doing a series going forward with predicting where some of these guys might end up going. You know, this is very important. We're going to see a lot of these guys get drafted and potentially skyrocket, you know, above what we might be thinking, you know, potentially Burns or Hagan Smith does, you know?
Yeah.
It is a very real possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love how you brought that in really full circle with the effects of the COVID season and just like what happens when you just, the like you said, the back end of those rotations are just, you know, it's so, the talent looks so different, but also what you said with the draft and how there's going to be a lot of guys kind of going in those first few rounds. Like, I think there's going to be some great values that continue to happen. This happened last year too, but the college pitchers going in the second round, like second round to third round, overall, you know, 50 to 80, there's going to be some really good arms that go in that range that didn't have great results in the college, or that had great results but don't have a ton of, like, you know, pedigree behind them. That's such a fun range for college pitchers, because you have more data on them, you have more information on them, you can go and watch their games sometimes, and so it's going to be fun. I really look forward to look at that and see kind of which guys fall and which ones there's definitely going to be a pitching prospect or two that gets pushed up, and we're gonna look at it and go like, oh, wasn't expecting that, you know. And then it's just really interesting because, like, the data that these teams have, you see, you know, well, we're going to take this guy because he's got a great fastball. I don't care what it did in college. I know the properties of this fastball, what it does, and that's what I want. And that's what a lot of these decisions are based on now. So it'll be really interesting to watch. And so this will definitely be a thread that we kind of keep up to date with as draft season happens, and just really, really interesting storylines kind of heading into the draft as well. Let's see here.
So, Jake, just to interject here real quick, exactly with what you're saying, I think especially, you know, with what we were just talking about with Christian Scott, right? You know, I've been doing some articles with Fantrax HQ highlighting some of these prospects since the beginning of the college baseball season. I've been trying to go through about 5 per week, diving deep into it. And I'm telling you, there is a lot of underrated college arms that are going to be in this draft class. That's really, really interesting. And even some relief pitchers that I think could be very Christian Scott-esque.
Mm.
You know,
I have great to ask, Rick. Who?
Well, you're going to have to check out my article on Fantrax HQ.
You're carrying water for Fantrax now? This is a pitcherless podcast.
I know. I'm sorry, Nick. Please don't find me. But, you know, that's the thing, man. You see a lot of these, you know, types of pitchers that'll have massive strikeout upside, great pitch forming and everything. So all they need is some more direction. And you can only have, you know, your 5 starters in college. So some of these RPs are going to be able to go. The innings will be there for them. I think it's going to be really interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So that's a bit of a breakdown on kind of what's happened in the college landscape right now. And we'll obviously keep up to date with that and whatnot. But we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to listen to the brilliance that is Rick Hake and his live look-ins, his live scouting reports, his eyeballs doing a lot of work for us. So we'll be back in just a minute. You'll get to hear all about it. All right, and we are back. And I am ready to hand over the reins, let Rick just take it away and tell us all about the wonderful things that he's been seeing. So, speaking of college, recently you got to take a look at a Wake Forest versus Clemson game. Really great ACC competition. Like I mentioned, Clemson is currently the 3rd ranked team in the country. Wake Forest in that top 25, right kind of at the edge there. And then, so we'd love to hear about that. And then we'll hear some more information about some affiliated games as well. But Rick, what do you have for us on that that first college game that you were able to see?
Yeah, so starting out with that, Wake Forest versus Clemson. Wake Forest ended up sweeping the series, which was pretty interesting. But then they got swept by NC State right afterwards. So, you know, wipe out.
Baseball.
That's baseball, Susan. So anyway, it was a good series. I was able to see Tristan Smith pitch for Clemson. He is a left-handed pitcher that's going to be in this year's draft class. Once again, a very interesting pitcher in his own right. Very efficient and effective with his fastball. Was really, really dotting the corners, moving it up and down. A three-quarter arm slot that was really interesting to see on the mound, especially as a left-handed pitcher. That was really nice. The fastball sat between 92, 94, and topped out at 95. He would reach back every once in a while and be able to get that 95 pretty frequently, so that was nice to see. The slider had a lot of movement to it, away to lefties, and then in on righties, back foot sliders. He was throwing a ton of them to Wake Forest early on, and they weren't really able to do much with him until he was gone. Only one player did. I'll talk about that later. The changeup got a ton of weak contact, so really worked well for his defenders behind him. Overall, really solid profile. Though I would say he's more than likely a back end starter. Probably a 4-5 type of starter, 6'3", so he's got the pitcher's build. But I have a feeling that he's going to probably go or slide a little bit in the draft. But this still a very, very solid profile here. So I'll be very curious to see where he ends up. The other one that I wanted to talk about here, there were some other key guys in Wake Forest, like Seaver King, and whatnot, but it wasn't much to say on this game. Nick Kurtz had a massive home run, off of Tristan Smith, one bad location. And I tell you, the raw power that Nick Kurtz has is insane. It literally looked like a pop-up, and it just kept carrying right on out. It was smooth and easy swings. You could see it on my Twitter at Must Be the Hawk. It's on there. But man, I tell you, ever since we talked about him, Jake, on here, he took it personally, obviously, because he went off. Like, yep. Ever since we talked about him,
he said, so, Rick Hake is a fool.
Yeah. He's like, I agree with what he's saying. I am a steal to any team, but I will show him what a steal does.
Right.
And he went on that massive home run spree. I think it was like 13 in like 15 games or less.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was unreal. But yeah, Nick Kurtz, he looks ready to go, primed and ready to go. Made some amazing defensive stops, which I know we don't talk about much from like a fantasy purpose. But whenever you have a first baseman make like it really impressive diving stops, it stands out. And especially after watching a lot of the minor league games, not a lot of these guys at first base are mobile. Like, yep. At all. And whenever you do see like top tier first base prospects, it's better, but it's not like this. Nick Kurtz is a great defender at first, and I think that will probably play a major factor on where he's drafted come the draft time. And quite frankly, Jake, I hope it's with Chicago.
Oh, that would be nice.
I do.
Yeah, okay. All right. Ooh, what, him and George Walkow in the same lineup.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good thought to have.
Yeah. It's real solid. And then here's the thing, like Nick Kurtz is a fundamentally good hitter that just got off to a horrendous start.
Yeah.
And you could tell, because I watched a lot of Wake Forest games in person, and you could tell that it was frustrating him that he wasn't being able to lift the ball the way he wanted to, and that he was literally just either smoking it to an outfielder or on the ground. He just was getting unlucky until all of a sudden he wasn't.
Yeah, right.
But it's just a little bit too late to still be that number one guy. which is not a problem because I think that it's still a great guy to be able to target in first year player drafts. I'll be really curious to see what he does once he is drafted and how much playing time he gets afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh yeah, he'll definitely be a fun one to watch there. What a great series to watch, loaded with talent. But moving into the minor leagues, the professional realm, you were able to see a friend of the pod face the White Sox organization, so is the Winston-Salem Dash, and forgive me, I don't know what team this is, Rick.
The Winston-Salem Dash and the Asheville Tourists.
Yeah, that's the one. I don't think I would have gotten that. So anyway, Trey Dombrowski.
Yes.
How's he doing, man? You were able to catch up with him. How'd that go?
I was able to catch up with him a couple times. Really generous with his time, obviously, on the podcast over the off season, now in season. Really, really cool guy to be able to catch up with. Before he made his start, he let me know that he was going to end up coming in as, I don't really know how to list this, Jake. I'm still trying to figure out what the correct terminology is for this.
Okay.
Houston basically is having a starter go mm-hmm. 4 to 5 innings, and then they have a piggyback starter. I guess that's what he would be called right now.
Okay.
A piggyback starter takes over either in the fifth, or the sixth, wherever. In Trey's case, it was the fifth. And they basically carry on until the end of the game, which
right.
Trey
okay.
did. He finished the game. It was two pitchers. No, it was technically three pitchers, but I'll explain that in a second. So the original starter went out there, and he was struggling left and right. But here's the main kicker. They had him going out, and he was throwing 95, 96 miles an hour. Last name's Castillo. I can't remember the first one. It was not that impressive to me personally. Once he struggled to a certain point in the fourth inning, they went to the bullpen to try to bring in another reliever to fill in the 2/3 of an inning that he had to do. Yeah. So they got that and they got that out. And then as soon as that was done, Trey went it. Now, Trey is about my height. 6'3", 6'4", somewhere in that range. Left-handed. He, if you recall, and you're an avid listener of the podcast, which why wouldn't you be? This is great. I mean, you listen to the silky voice of Jake. Why not? with Trey, as we talked about before, he works primarily as a lower velocity pitcher. So coming in after a 95-mile-an-hour, starter, these guys were ready for the 95. He's coming in at 91. 90 to 91 was pretty much where he was sitting. He was reaching back for 91. It was primarily sitting at 90 miles an hour, but he was dotting the corners. He was up and down in the zone with the fastball. And man, that slider was working. The slider, the curveball, it looked fantastic. Massive movement, massive drop. And those batters looked silly whenever they were trying to swing. It was on whenever he was out there. Now, with the changeup, he was able to induce weak contact. The fastball, usually with the fastball, he'll work it up and down. But, obviously, if they get connected up, it's going to go up in the air. He didn't give loud contact at all, but he did give up some fly balls. Those are easy outs, not a problem. The changeup, though, would get hit weakly, but his defenders behind him dropped the ball. Three times, three errors, and I swear there was a fourth one, but they didn't count it. You could easily see, because Trey is a gamer. Like, I saw that immediately with him on the mound. Well, I mean, we talked with him here on the pod, but on the mound, you could tell he's a gamer. He's into it, and I was watching him, and I was trying to see if he was going to lit that moment, take advantage of what was happening. And he didn't let it get to him. You could see he was frustrated, but he didn't let him get to him. He got through the game and was just fine. It wasn't a great outing by the stat sheet, but he did very well in my book. I met up with him afterwards and, talked to him a little bit. And Unfortunately, it's something that right now that Asheville defense is having a problem with defensively.
370 BABIP, by the way, behind him right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really bad. And then on top of that, I asked him, because if you have it pulled up right now, Jake, I don't have it in front of me, but his home and away splits were insane when I saw him. His home split was like, oh my gosh, it was like an 80 ERA. And I asked him about that, and I was like, you know, what's going on here? I think at the time it was like a 3.2 on the road and an 8.4 at home. And he was telling me, man, that ballpark is miserable. A fly ball turns into a home run all the time there. That paired with the defense behind him, it's been a rough going.
Mm. Yeah, I got it pulled up here. Okay, so, oh my God. At home, 13.2 innings, 15 strikeouts, 7 walks, 10.54 ERA, 2.268 whip. On the road, 15.1 innings pitched, 20 strikeouts, 3 walks, a 5.28 ERA, and a 1.17 whip.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
It's a big difference. And here's the thing, like, he is a command pitcher, so the walks are very kind of concerning as well. But here's the thing, he's facing advanced hitters, not the same as what he faced in low A. So in low A, you know, you're going to get a lot of swing and miss outside the zone. These guys are going to hold back a little bit. So sometimes you're going to end up giving up a little bit more walks. Not as much concerned about that. But yeah, that defense behind him has been atrocious. That BABIP, like you said, really stands out. So, you know, I'm hoping that he can be able to try to turn it around and get it going from there. Was really good to be able to talk to the two times I talked to him while he was out there. Really generous with this time. Also in that series, watched a lot more Jacob Gonzalez in his bats. He did get a homer in the series, not off of Dombrowski, but he did get a homer. He went 4-for-5 in the one game that I saw there. After that series, they went on the road and they promoted him to Double A. We saw it coming. You know, it wasn't a major shock. What came as more of a shock is the fact that they brought Noah Schultz with him.
Yeah.
So I was able to see a couple starts of Noah Schultz down in Winston, which is good. I'm glad I was able to do that. And his last start, 97 with a fastball, working up in the zone, mixing in the changeup a little bit more. Something I didn't see in the first couple outings that I saw from him. So he's working it a little bit more. That slider is absolutely filthy, man. It's really getting great movement, especially the right-handed batters in. But yeah, he's promoted to Double A Birmingham with Jacob Gonzalez. So that's always a nice thing to be able to see there. The update with Samuel Zavala, he continues to struggle. I have been like watching his numbers really closely, as well as his body language. When you're looking at his numbers, he's still walking at a very good clip. He's not striking out a ton, so he's not getting fooled. He's working counts every time he goes up there. He makes the contact, and it's just not falling his way. He's clearly getting frustrated. You can see it right away. I think right now he's currently batting below 200. So it's going to take some time for him to be able to get right the ship and get going. He could really stand to spend some extra time in Winston, even whenever he does get it right. And I hope that they do. He could stand to get his confidence back before he ends up moving up to Birmingham. So.
Yeah, he's so much great tools on him. And I mean, even like, you know, looking at his stat line, you know, he's still like, he had 3 homers, still 5 bases. He's only striking out 23% of the time, still walking 13% of the time. So, you know, he's got some, you know, good baseline of skills. But yeah, the BABIP sitting at 230 right now, 184 average overall. So that's tough. But I actually, not really based off of your advice, but with your voice in mind, Rick, recently I made a purchase. I got a little baseball card. I'm showing it to you on the screen here, of Samuel Zavala. His so I'm really into Bowman. course, being a prospector. And I found this dude on Twitter was having a fire sale. Don't buy stuff on the internet from people in general. I'm not advocating for that, but every once in a while it works out. But it's a PSA 10. Little first Bowman Chrome card of Samuel Zavala on the Padres. Mm. Right into the collection. Thank you, Rick. Even though he's kind of sucking right now. it's a good, I think he's a good White Sox prospect to get, because there's hasn't been a ton of them recently, but they're getting better. They're building up a little bit, but just want to show that to you, because that's one of the more recent additions to my collection here. And thanks to your loving words on the show.
I appreciate it. I just a small side story here. I started collecting some Bowman Chrome or Bowman cards a little while back, and I ended up getting a Colton Cowser and Connor Norby pull, and it just so happened that they happened to be in Greensboro. This was before I was with Fantrax and all that. I was with the streamer, so I was able to do this. And I was able to talk to them for a little while, and then I had Cowser sign my card and Norby as well.
That's awesome.
Which was really, really cool. So that was awesome. It's so much fun being able to do this, because, like, usually whenever I have my girls, they always bring baseballs to sign because they love having the players sign it.
Right, yeah.
Like Marcelo Mayer. What else we got? I think I – Nick Gonzalez I have right up above me. And Blaze Jordan. Yeah, cool guys. Tried to get Volpe once, but he was like, now I got to go work out. And I was like, oh, okay. We'll see how this is.
Yeah, but, right.
Anyway, but...
It's fun, man. It's fun. Especially you got the kids involved, you know, getting them. And it's just so much fun to see the joy that it brings, you know?
I was hoping to be able to get an interview with Jacob Gonzalez before he got the call. I actually lined up a time to be able to do that. He's just very hard to be able to get a hold of. But I wish him the best. He was ready to go. He looked ready. Like it won't surprise me if he, you know, sticks around AA maybe till the end of the year. It wouldn't surprise me if he gets bumped to Charlotte by the end of the year. You know, when it comes to the White Sox, and I'm not being mean by this, but like they still need some work in terms of like what they need coming up.
Yeah.
And Brian Ramos coming up is a good thing. I saw him a lot in Winston whenever he was here, and I liked what I saw, but like they're not ready to make that push to start people's clocks. And
right.
My point of bringing up with Kurtz, and I don't mean to like ramble on this. You can cut me off at any time, but, my point with Kurtz, because my thought, it kind of a pre into our show next week or so, my thought with Kurtz would be he would be perfect for either Chicago, White Sox, because Vaughn is going to be becoming expensive, and he might be a piece that you guys might want to move for other pieces, or the Cardinals. Yeah. Because they primarily focus on defense first.
Yeah, yeah.
And Goldschmidt is going to be expiring in the next couple of years, probably around the time Nick Kurtz is going to be
die?
Pretty
He's going to be expiring.
his contract.
Maybe retiring.
Yeah, you know what? You know what? I own that one. I have that one. Retiring, maybe.
Yeah, okay, all right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, he's going to be gone somewhere.
Either way, I think he could be the heir apparent, and I think he'd be a great heir apparent. He looks like... Yeah. When you see him in person, he just looks like a Cardinal.
Mm.
But I would love to see him stay in Winston-Salem and just play with the Dash right after being drafted. That would be great. But with Winston, they got some good pieces. I'm so conflicted on if they need a starter or if they need, you know, another position player, because the position players are looking kind of rough. The starters, I don't really know, besides Schultz, you know, what is going to be their long-term ace, if it's in-house or if it's elsewhere that they have to go. And that's hard to say after they just got rid of Giolito and they just got rid of, blanking.
Lance Lynn.
No.
The homegrown guy, Cease.
Yes, Cease. There we go. Yeah. So, like, you know, after just trading an ace like Cease, like, if you feel like your window of opportunity is coming, you extend Cease.
Right.
And you don't move
it's him. Not coming. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. I don't mean to be mean by that.
Even if the prospects, their top prospects, like, really work out, like, having a major league roster of these guys, like, you know, even with the Orioles, like, they're, I mean, obviously they're a really great team. Like, you're just not guaranteed, even if you stockpile all the top prospects, you're just not guaranteed for that to actually be a competent major league lineup. You know, there's still so many roster moves that are made once these guys hit the major leagues to then supplement their skills and build a complete team. There's so much that goes into it. I mean, it's just, and we saw it with the White Sox last rebuild, like, the guys that they had just weren't good enough. And right now they have nowhere near the talent that they had before. So I don't think it's going to be a while. And I am, I think I've come to terms with that.
Yeah. Cause we'll just see. Like in a dynasty format in yeah. the 10 team yeah. league, I stockpiled a ton of prospects, but you got to expect only like 25% of them to pan out at best.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing. Like, you got Colson Montgomery, who's going to be a very solid player. Is he going to be a superstar? I don't know.
Probably not.
But very, very solid. Mm-hmm. And Noah Schultz has got a ton of upside. He's very Sale-esque mm-hmm. in how he does things, which is fantastic. And he's cut down the walks. Like, he looks great. But you got to put pieces around him. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
We'll see. We'll see. Another team that you saw play the Winston-Salem Dash is the Bowling Green, the affiliate of the Tampa Bay Rays. So you're able to see get a couple looks of some guys that you don't normally see here. It's funny to talk about who you saw that caught your eye from that Rays organization playing for Bowling Green against the Dash.
Yeah. So the two people I really wanted to see was Xavier Isaac as well as Trey Morgan. Now, Isaac sat. Trey Morgan played in the one game that I saw last night. And Trey Morgan, I am all in. I found him very, very interesting while he played at LSU.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting from the fact that he would hit for average and OBP, but he did not show off like any power. I think he hit 4 home runs total at LSU in his final season there. So like, we were not seeing the power. Now, fast forward, he gets drafted by the Rays, which I'm sorry, they've done this before with a guy named Kyle Manzardo. Maybe you heard of him. I don't know.
Here and there.
So they get Trey Morgan, and he blows up low A. Absolutely blows up low A. And is hitting for power, more or less power down there. He's starting to get to it. And then he gets bumped up here. He plays 6 games before I saw him in Winston. In those 6 games, he did not strike out once. And in the game I saw him, he didn't strike out once.
He's yet to strike out. Yeah.
He is yet. I don't know if he did tonight, but who knows. But absolutely fantastic at-bats. He crushed 2 doubles to left field. So that was awesome to see. He can move really well. I see in his frame that there's a lot more power to come. I think that we're looking at a very, very similar profile to what we saw with Kyle Manzardo. So this could be very solid long-term for either the Rays or another team. You know, he also fits the Yandy Diaz mold as well. So this is something the Rays have a lot of success kind of coaxing out. So I'm all in on Trey Morgan. This is a guy that I really do want to try to target in a majority of these dynasty leagues going forward, because either way, whether it's with the Rays or somebody else, he is going to be useful, just like Manzardo is for Cleveland right now.
Yeah, and I did look it up. This tonight, he did strike out. He struck out once in 5 plate appearances. And let me do the math real quick. That's 1 strikeout in 38 1 in 38 plate appearances for a 2.6% strikeout rate.
That's getting it done. And I think whenever I saw him, he was batting .583.
Yes. Yeah. Now it's, he also got hit today. So now it's .533.
Ooh, that's going down, but it's all right.
I mean, it's still about .500. That's probably, yeah, that'll work.
I mean, you got to be happy about half of your at bats are getting hit.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so. Yeah. That was good. And then follow that up with the Rays' first round draft pick from last year. So if I'm not mistaken, I believe Trey Morgan was their either their second or their third round draft pick. That eludes me at the first moment. It is third. Okay. Brayden Taylor, he was from TCU, third base prospect. Solid build. Good movement, you know, from the defensive side of it. A solid build. He looked a little overmatched early on, but we'll get to that in just a moment with the pitcher that he was facing. But he ended up settling in. He drove a hard single off of Johnny Ray, a reliever for Winston-Salem, at about 95 miles an hour. So it was, you know, pretty solid. But his at bats for the whole were pretty darn good. This year in high A, he's actually walking 21.3%. So once again, he is a stereotypical Rays prospect that is going to get his walks. He's going to get on base. You know, he struck out, I think, twice the night that I saw him. So although he did work the at-bats, he did end up getting a strikeout, but he did end up, you know, getting his base hit. So solid for the first round draft pick out of TCU. I like that. The last one I wanted to talk about here, for Winston, would be Tyler Schweitzer. Now, he's a left-handed pitcher with a dash. He's not somebody that I would normally talk about in this spot, but I've seen him now this year three times. I've seen him three or four times last year. He is such a fun pitcher to watch. I think he could potentially be a back-end rotational piece, but long-term, I think he's a long reliever type. The fastball sits around 92 to 93, but he can reach back at 94, 95 if he wants it. He was painting the corners up and down and really making Bowling Green work for it. The secondary pitches, that slider and curveball, were moving really, really well. Very, very similar to Trey Dombrowski in how he goes about it, but just with a little bit more velocity, but very, very similar. He was from Ball State previously. Very solid pitcher. The changeup is really nice because it tunnels very well and very similarly to the fastball. So these hitters just were not able to do much with what he was able to do. And whenever they were able to hit it, it was usually on the ground. So it was weak contact. A lot of fun. It's an intangible that I don't think that you really see much. He was cutting up with his catcher going in and out, you know, of the game. They pitch him deep into these games, and deep being like 6 to 7 innings. So he's a guy that I really enjoyed watching quite a bit.
Yeah. Love that. Good to see when you get, you know, cause like we were talking about earlier on the show, like a lot of these guys are handled with extreme care. And mm-hmm. So just to see guys go out there and just let it eat, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Especially in person. Yeah. Being able to see that, that's great. So you had one more game here listed that you wanted to, that a couple guys to talk about. So Pittsburgh affiliate and the Boston affiliate, the Hillsboro Grasshoppers? No.
No, Greensboro.
Grasshoppers. And then the Greenville, this is what tripped me up.
Yes.
And you had the Greenville team for the Red Sox. Forgive me, everybody. I'm still learning my lower level affiliates here.
You're gonna be a professional by the end of this.
No, right? Yeah, I think we need to make some flashcards. so I could study.
Side note on this one. There's a player. I just blanked on his last name.
Yeah, see, it's not so easy.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Gusage. Gossage, something like that. Anyway, for a Winston-Salem with the dash, and I want to create flashcards or these big poster cards so bad, being like the goose is on the loose. I want to be that fan, man, but you got to be professional, so you can't do it. But yes, the Greenville Drive, Greensboro Grasshoppers versus the Greenville Drive. I see a lot of Greensboro because I do live here. For the Drive, two guys really stood out right away, and they were the two that I really wanted to see the most of. was Cutter Coffey, in which he was playing third base, which was pretty awesome to see. I was curious. I would have thought that he would play second with Mickey Romero playing shortstop, but yeah, they had him at third, and he's bulked up quite a bit too since being drafted. Had a big poolside 2-run home run in the first inning, but put together some really solid bats throughout, and did it on a very hot day, by the way. So kudos to him. Daytime game. You gotta love daytime baseball. For the drive as well, Mickey Romero, this will always go down as a Heim Bloom special, right? But shortstop, he had a great game, started off the game with a double off the left field wall. And then in his second at bat, he had a solo home run. I got a video of that up on Twitter, so you can go and check that out. Looks bigger too. It looks like he's bulked up quite a bit, because I saw him last season in Salem, low A, Salem, and he was quite skinny at that point. So he's definitely bulked up to a point to be able to get to more power. Speaking of power, this was a home run fest in Greensboro, and Tamar Johnson did not want to be excluded from that. He was very offended that Mickey Romero did that. So
yeah,
the Grasshoppers, which we need to figure out something different. We got a new logo, but we need a new name. We'll be taking offers on names. You can send it to PL on the Farm Twitter.
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
There you go. And I'll submit them to people who actually care. So Tamar was DHing for this game. Really loud contact. Despite his horrible average this season, he hits the ball really, really hard.
And I love that.
Yeah, I mean, because good things happen to people who hit the ball hard.
It's pretty simple, actually, yeah.
And here's the thing. He went into the draft as like a high contact guy. You know, high contact, high power. You know, this was supposed to be a can't-miss guy who had no speed, which he doesn't. He doesn't really have much speed, which is crazy, too, because he's, like, really small stature-wise. But, yeah, he crushed a solo home run. And whenever you watch the video up on my Twitter, you will see it, like, coast off the bat. I bet you he thought that it was a pop fly. His reaction after the ball left the bat was that it was that of a pop fly, and it just kept carrying. So yeah, that was the fun that I saw in Greensboro versus the drive, and I'm hoping to either get out again tomorrow night to either Winston or Greensboro, probably more so Winston, though, because I do want to see some more from Cooper Kenny. He was also a prospect that I didn't mention in this, but he ended up hitting a home run, solo shot. He looked really good. Brock Jones was in that lineup as well. John Diaz, for those of you who stashed him like myself for so many years, he's really fast. But that's it.
Rick, you're doing the good work, and I really appreciate it, because it is so fascinating to listen to the takeaways that you have from these games that you're able to go see. And man, it just sounds like such a fun time. So obviously, as always, appreciate you kind of going out and venturing into the world and bringing back some wonderful tidbits of information about all the things that are happening down in the Carolinas in the minor leagues. So props to you as always. And well, folks, that'll do it. That is the episode that we had prepared for y'all. So make sure you tune in to the next one that we're going to have for you right now, slated for Friday the 31st of May. And of course, as always, you know, you can find myself on Twitter at Jake Mache, Rick at Must Be the Hawk, and the podcast at PL on the Farm. And I'm going to need all y'all to go and have yourselves a great baseball week.